else, and the unease that had set into her soul when she entered that castle. Even before anything had happened, she'd known that had been an evil place, the haunt of monsters and madness. This was different. Reflecting upon her emotions, she realized she was depressed, not afraid. Whatever walked here, walked alone, lived alone. It hid away in the dark, not from malice, but from shame, fear, self-disgust. She opened a door and a stench enveloped her. Her sense of smell was keener than a human's, and she had to hold her nose until the first wave had dissipated. Her stomach convulsed, and she would have vomited if there'd been any food in her. She didn't need to eat, but sometimes did so to be sociable or to sample a taste. But she hadn't taken anything solid for weeks. The nausea spasms were like blows to her abdomen. Standing up, she looked into the cupboard. It was something's larder, well stocked with pale sewerfish, dog-sized rats, various small, altered creatures. The meat animals of the labyrinth all bore the taint of warpstone. The fish were eyeless or possessed of rudimentary forelimbs. The rats had heads out of proportion with their thin, furred bodies. Other beasts were unidentifiable as what they had formerly been. They'd all been killed by something strong that broke necks or took large bites from its prey. Evidently, the epicure would not touch meat that was not yet a few days rotten, and these morsels had been left to putrefy a little, until they were fit to serve the larder keeper's tastes. Gods, Genevieve swore. What a way to live. Moving on, she came to a drop that fell away into the depths of the city like a cliff. It was covered with what looked like a ship's rigging, a net of thick ropes, sturdy if tattered. It would be comparatively easy to climb down, but she thought that adventure could wait for another night. Down below, she heard water lapping. Turning away, she confidently expected to be able to retrace her steps. Within 50 paces, she was in new territory, lost. She thought she was still on the same level as the theatre, and if she held still, she could even hear the distant sounds of Felix's overture. She could not have gone that far into the labyrinth. There were trapdoors all over the place. Some must lead back to the public ways of the house. Trying another promising door, she found herself surrounded by books and papers, stuffed into floor-to-ceiling shelves. There was a longbane taper burning, giving the room a woody, pleasant smell. Longbane was known as Scholar's Ruin, because its fumes were mildly euphoric, mildly addictive. This was a fairly ordinary theatre library. There were much used and scribbled on copies of standard works, a full set of the plays of Taradash, actors and directors' copies of other repertory warhorses, some basic texts on stagecraft, a bundled collection of playbills, scrolled posters, a bound folio of Detlef Sierck was upside down among the other books. Genevieve looked about, wondering if any unusual book might turn up here, some grimoire of power bound in human skin and holding the key to a vast magical design. There was nothing of the sort. What she did find was a whole case given over to books by someone of whom she had barely heard, a playwright of the previous century named Bruno Malvoisin. He was the author of Seduced by Slaanesi, which she remembered as a scandalous piece in its day. Apart from that, he'd contributed nothing which still lived in the repertoire. She read the titles of plays from the elegant spines of the books. The Tragedy of Margrethe, The Seventh Voyage of Sigmar, Bold Benvolio, Anastalian's Treachery, Vengeance of Vaumont, The Rape of Rachel. A whole life was wrapped up between these covers. A life spent and forgotten. Evidently, Bruno Malvoisin meant something to the inhabitant of the labyrinth. That might help solve the puzzle. She must ask Detlef if he knew anything about the man, or, more usefully, Papa Fritz. The stage doorkeeper was an inexhaustible fount of theatrical lore. She stepped back into the passageway and tried the next trapdoor. It led to a small space that smelled of bread and belched a pocket of warm air at her. Genevieve almost passed it by, but then recognised that the back of the space was a door as well. She pulled herself into the recess and pushed the door. A heavy iron flap, but unlocked. Open. Slipping out of one of the ovens, she found herself in the kitchen of the Varga Bruegel Memorial Playhouse. A chef turned, gasped, and dropped a tray of intermission pastries. "Sorry," she said. "I thought I was cooked through." Chapter 11. Throughout the play, the Animus observed Detlef Sierck. In their scenes together, Eva was close to him, and the Animus could see through the filter of her mind. The actor was a huge man, almost swollen, physically strong, a powerful projector. This host wouldn't formally have been able to best him in a struggle. Even with the Animus guiding her, taking away any restraints of pain or conscience, she might take a long time to overcome him. And Eva knew that, frail as she might seem, the vampire would be even more resilient. With the rider in her mind, Eva lived the role of Nita as never before, wrestling the piece away from Detlef and the other players. The second act curtain was hers, as she returned on her knees to Chaida, lifting her scarf away from her bruises and throwing herself upon his mercy. The tableau was thunderously applauded. Once the curtain was rung down, Detlef said, "Good work, Eva. But perhaps from now on, less is more." As she stood up, the scene shifters working around them to change the stage set, Detlef looked at her. Sweat was pouring from him, beads glistening through his monster face paint. His role was exhausting. Reinhardt swarmed around and kissed her on the cheek. "Magnificent," he said. "A revelation." Detlef frowned, his Chaida brows moving together ferociously. "She gets better and better, don't you think?" "Of course," the actor-manager nodded. "You're a star," Reinhardt said, touching her chin with his thumb. The Animus knew that Reinhardt Jessner wanted sexual congress with its host. From Bernabe Schaet, it understood lust. "Just remember," Detlef said, "at the end of the play, I kill you." Eva smiled and nodded humbly. The Animus sampled the complicated emotions that ticked over inside the host's head. She was more ordered in her thoughts than Schaet, the supposed devotee of the law, had been. In her single-mindedness, she was very like the Animus itself. In the near distance, she had purposes, and every step she took brought her nearer their achievement. Surprised, the Animus found itself in sympathy with Eva Savinian. Coolly, professionally, the host stood to one side of the stage, allowing her dresser to change her shawl and a makeup artist to dab stage blood and blue bruising onto her face.
"More flowers,"
said an old man Eva knew as Papa Fritz.
"Flowers from the palace."
The Animus allowed Eva a tight smile. She thought the admiration of influential men a distraction. Despite everything, despite her resolve, despite her calculation, her life was for the theatre. She thought of taking lovers, patrons, a place in society, but they were just underpinnings. Her purpose was out in the limelight, out on the stage. Eva understood she was different and didn't expect to be loved by individuals. Only the audience counted, the collective heart, which was hers to win.
"And a special bouquet," Papa Fritz continued,
"from a kind spirit."
A chill struck Eva, surprising the Animus. Papa Fritz held out a card. upon which was written, "From the occupant of Box 7.
"That's the trapdoor demon's perch," he explained.
A panic grew inside Eva, but the animus soothed it away. Sampling the girl's memory, it understood her instinctive fears, understood the tangle into which she'd got herself. It could help her overcome these untidy emotions, and so it did. The animus was beginning to lose its sense of a distinct identity. It had started to think of itself as herself. Its former existence was a dream. Now it was Eva Savinian. She was Eva. Her name was called, and without a thought, she took up her place on the dark stage. The curtains parted, and the light came up. Nita lived. Eva was different tonight. Of course, the trapdoor demon had expected that. After the shock she'd had, most actresses would not even have gone on this evening. He couldn't understand, though, how she could be so magnificent. She was a different person on stage. The screaming girl in the dressing room was left behind somewhere, and all the audience could see was Nita. He wondered how much of the luminousness of her playing was down to fear, down to the memory of the thing she had seen. Having confronted a monster in her real life, was she better able to understand Mr. Chaida's mistress? Later, would she come back to her guiding spirit, just as the Kislevite drab persistently crawled to her abusive lover? The ghost was almost frightened. He understood Eva the actress, but he couldn't begin to fathom out Eva the woman. He didn't even really believe there was such a person. In Box 7, he was racked with sobs, stifling the noise, feeling the tears leaking from his huge eyes. On the stage, Nita cringed under a torrent of abuse from Chaida. The monster took a willow switch to her back and poured forth a stream of obscenities, insults, taunts. The trapdoor demon, like the rest of the audience, was held, horror-struck. Detlef Siak's Chaida capered like an ape, almost dancing with glee as he inflicted hurt upon hurt. As Eva's performance grew in strength, so she pushed her co-star to greater lengths. Evil was in the Vagabroigel Theatre. Concentrated under the lights, shining for all to see. Detlef's Zykel and Chaida would be remembered as one of his great roles. It went beyond makeup. It was as if the playwright were truly living out the duality, the heights of nobility, the depths of depravity. Some might fear for the performer's sanity and assume he had gone the way of the notorious Laszlo Lohenstein, the horrors of his stage roles overwhelming his real life until man and monster became indistinguishable. On stage, Mr. Chaida clumped with heavy boots over the prone form of the innkeeper's child, gleefully stomping the life out of her. Listening from his hiding places, the trapdoor demon had learned that tickets for Dr. Zykel and Mr. Chaida were changing hands at 10 times their face value. Every night, masked dignitaries were cramming into the boxes, unable to bear not having seen the piece. More seats were being squeezed into the stalls and circle, and commoners were paying a week's wage to stand by the walls just to wonder at the spectacle, to be a part of the occasion. The audience screamed as the innkeeper's daughter's head came off, and Chaida booted it into the wings. It was magical and fragile. No one knew how long the spell would last. Eventually, the play might fall into a set pattern and become a routine entertainment, and those lucky enough to see it early on would look with pity upon those who came later in the run. The scene changed. Nita was alone now, singing her song, trying to beg from unseen passers-by the kopecks she needed to bribe the gatekeeper to let her out of the city. Away from Chaida, she might have a chance. Back in her village, she could find a life. Half the audience was trying to hide their tears. Her hands out, she felt the buffeting of the uncaring Kislevites. Her song ended, and she slipped to the stage, fluttering scraps of paper drifting about her to signify the famous Kislev Snows. In her ragged clothes, Nita shivered, hugging herself. Then the shadow of Chaida fell upon her, and her doom was sealed. Chapter 12. It was taking Detlef longer to recover after each performance. There were 3 major fights, 4 violent love scenes, and 6 murders in the script, plus the physically grueling transformation scenes. He was picking up as many bruises as a pit fighter. He must be sweating off pounds, although that didn't seem to be affecting his gut. Tonight, he'd barely been able to stand up for the curtain calls. Once the piece was over, the weight of weariness fell on him from a great height. They were all calling for Eva anyway. He could easily fade into the scenery. Once the curtain was down for the last time, Reinhardt had to help him off the stage, choosing a path between the ropes and flats. There was a pile of floral offerings the size of an ox cart heaped up by the ladies' dressing rooms, all for Eva. Scraping at his face, pulling off his Chaida deformities, he staggered to his own dressing room and collapsed on a divan, head pounding like a blacksmith's anvil. He was sure Reinhardt had stabbed him during the fight, but had so many pains that he couldn't isolate any individual wound. His dresser soaked a cloth and dropped it on his forehead. Detlef garbled out a thanks. He was still shaking, still in the grips of Mr. Chaida. When he shut his eyes, he saw Eva Savinian, mutilated and dismembered. He saw rivulets of blood in the streets of Altdorf. He saw children thrown into open fires, human bodies rent apart, entrails strewn in the dirt, eyes pecked by ravens, tongues pulled out. He woke out of his doze, horrors still vivid in his mind. Guglielmo was there with the broadsheets. They were full of the latest Warhawk murder. "The watch don't know who the beggar was," Guglielmo said. "The regular beggars in Temple Street claim never to have seen him, although he doesn't exactly have a face you could identify. He wore an amulet of Solkan, but the assumption is that he stole it. There's no connection with the other victims, no connection with the theatre." Detlef could imagine the hawk's spiked feet latching onto human flesh, the beak gouging skin, hammering at bone. "I've ordered an extra patrol of the night guard on the street, and I'm putting a few bruises in the building tonight. This whole thing stinks of trouble. What with Eva's broken mirror and the Warhawk death, I think we might have the beginnings of a curse here." Detlef sat up, his back and arms aching. Papa Fritz was in the room too, looking solemn.
"This house has had curses before," the old man said. "Strange flower. It seems the trapdoor demon took against it. The production never got to the first night. Illnesses, accidents, mishaps, assaults, disagreements, the whole thing."
"There is no curse," Detlef said. "Dr. Zykil and Mr. Chaida is a success."
"There have been cursed successes."
Detlef snorted, but he couldn't summon up the contempt for superstition that would once have burst forth unasked when anyone talked of curses on plays. Actors were quite capable of fouling up a production without supernatural intervention.
"Tybalt's called for us to be shut down again," said Guglielmo. "I don't know what's got into him. Some moral crusade or other marched up and down outside all evening. Rotten fruit was thrown at the front of the theatre, and a couple of heavies tried to rough up the ticket takers."
Genevieve appeared.
"Genet," he said. "A voice of sanity."
"Maybe," she replied, kissing his cheek. She smelled peculiarly of fresh bread.
"Where have you been?"
She did not answer him, but asked a question of her own.
"Who was Bruno Malvoisin?"
author of Seduced by Slaneshi. That Bruno Malvoisin.
Yes, him.
An old playwright, Bretonian originally, but he wrote in Reichspiel, so he must have been an imperial citizen.
That's all?
That's all I know, Detlef said, not understanding. He must have died 50 years ago. Papa Fritz shook his head.
No, sir. Malvoisin didn't die, exactly.
Genevieve turned to the old man.
You know about him.
What is all this, Genet?
Detlef asked.
A mystery, she said. Papa Fritz?
Yes, mademoiselle. I know about Bruno Malvoisin. I've been in the theatre a long time. I've seen them come, and I've seen them go. All the greats, all the failures. When I was a young man, Malvoisin was a famous playwright, a director, too.
Here, in Altdorf.
Here, in this house. When I was an usher's apprentice, he was a resident playwright. He suffered under a curse. Some of his works were banned, suppressed. The emperor of the day branded Seduced by Slaneshi obscene.
That I know about, Detlef interjected. It's pretty filthy, although has a certain style. We might revive it one season, suitably amended and updated.
He was a brooding man, obsessed, hard to work with. He fought a duel with the manager of the theatre, hacked his head half off for cutting a curtain speech.
A likable fellow, then.
A genius, sir. You have to make allowances for genius.
Yes, Detlef said. Of course.
What happened to him? Genevieve asked.
He began to alter. Warpstone must have got into him. They said Seduced by Slaneshi offended the chaos gods, and Sinch took a terrible revenge on him. His face changed, and he began to turn into something not human. He wrote furiously, dark, delirious, difficult stuff. Mad plays that could never be staged. He wrote an epic verse romance, alleging that the emperor had made a mistress of a she-goat. It was published anonymously, but the watch traced him as the author. He was hardly human then. Finally, shunned by all, Malvoisin disappeared mysteriously, slipped away into the night.
Detlef nodded.
Just the thing Malvoisin would do. His plays never have disappearances that aren't mysterious, and no one in them ever slips away into the afternoon. What has all this nonsense about an old hack got to do with anything?
Everyone looked at Genevieve. She thought a while before saying anything. At last, she came out with it.
I think Bruno Malvoisin is our trapdoor demon.
Chapter 13. With Bernabé Chait and the nameless mountain whore, the act of sexual congress had been a simple thing the animus had been able to understand. Chait had offered money for pleasure, and then promised not to give the girl pain if she acceded to his wishes. Actually, Chait had reneged. He had neither passed over coin nor refrained from hurting her. The abuse of the girl, terrorizing her even after she proved compliant, had been part of the cleric's desire. It had been as important, or more so, than the simple physical gratification. With Eva Savinian and Reinhard Jessner, the act was the same, but the meaning was different. The animus found itself caught up in Eva's thoughts as she admitted Reinhard into her body, as she let the actor see in her the fulfillment of his desires. She felt pleasure, genuine pleasure, but exaggerated it for his benefit. The animus was an amateur in these matters, and let itself be guided by Eva. The Congress was better for the actress than it had been for the cleric, perhaps because she expected less of it. He had willingly come with her, escorting her home after the performance. She rented a bare garret in the theatre district of Altdorf, one of many identical rooms in the area. Later, she'd have a house, luxuries, many clothes. Now this was just a place to sleep when she was not at the Varga Bruegel. She'd brought other lovers here, her first acting tutor, one of Huberman's musicians, but the liaisons had never outlasted her partner's professional usefulness. She had no shrine in her room, no pictures on the walls. Aside from the bed, the main item of furniture was a desk at which she studied her parts. A shelf above it weighed down with reading copies of the plays in the Varga Bruegel's repertoire, with her roles underlined and annotated. After their companionable, fairly affectionate lovemaking, Reinhardt was overwhelmed. The animus was puzzled, but Eva understood. Shaking by her, Reinhardt was thinking of his wife and children. He sat up, the quilt falling away from his chest, and reached for the wine bottle on the stand by the bed. Eva propped herself up on a pillow and watched her lover gulp down drink. Moonlight shone on his damp skin, making him pale as a ghost. He was bruised from his nightly duel with Detlef Sierk. She cuddled next to him and pulled him back down, stroking his hair, quieting his shivers. She couldn't stop his guilts, but she could ignore them. Eva's mind was racing. The carnal warmth had passed from her heart, and she was calculating. She'd been able to make Reinhardt want her, but could she make the man love her? The animus didn't understand the distinction. She thought on, pondering the success and implications of her latest move. The animus wasn't capable of being taken by surprise, but it noted that for a moment, Eva had gained control of their shared mind. The host dared be impatient with it, dared assume its purpose was subordinate to her own. Eva had won Reinhardt as an ally. As things stood, she could cajole and blackmail him to her cause with further favours or a threat of exposure. But he'd be a stronger partisan if he loved her outright, if he was bound to her by ties stronger than lust or fear. She found something inside herself that brought tears to her eyes. She lay still, not overdoing it, letting the tears well and flow. Tensing, she gave the impression that she was fighting against a burst of emotion. She waited for Reinhardt to take notice. He reared over her and touched a wet cheek. "Eva," he said. "What is it?"
"I was thinking," she said. "Thinking of your wife."
Her words were like a dagger in Reinhardt's throat. The animus savoured the small hurt.
"What a lucky woman she must be," Eva said,
seeming to be bravely trying to smile.
"People like Ilona. She'll always be popular. I know what people think of me. It isn't easy being me, and I can't change."
He was comforting her now, his own doubts forgotten. Deep inside, they were satisfied. The animus felt the warmth of her achievement.
"Don't cry," he said. "My love."
Eva had him.
"Genet, why do I feel vast schemes are being laid against me?"
She had no answer beyond,
"Because maybe there are,"
and had the wit not to say that. It was late, and they were still at the theatre, on the couch in Detlef's dressing room. Captain Kleindienst had wanted to ask some questions about the Warhawk killing, but they had honestly not been able to help him. However, the ice-chip eyes of the watchman, famous as the man who had exposed the beast, had made Genevieve uncomfortable. He seemed like another vampire hater. And his pet scryer, a red-headed young woman named Rosanna Ophuls, had been confused by the tangle of leftover emotions and impressions that clung to the Varga Bruegel. She'd not been able to stand being in the theatre more than a few minutes, and Kleindienst had allowed her to wait outside in his carriage.
"They'll catch the warhawk, Detlef. Like they caught Yefimovich, or the revolutionist Klojowski."
Both felons were still at large, on the run. The empire was overrun with murderers and anarchists.
"Maybe they won't catch him. But it will end. Everything ends."
"Everything?"
He looked piercingly at her. She remembered Ilona Horvathy's similar look when Genevieve had told her everyone grew old.
"I'm 36, Genet, and everyone takes me for 10 or 15 years older. You're what?"
668.
He smiled and touched her face with a paw-like, trembling hand.
"People think you're my daughter."
He stood up and wandered to his mirror. Detlef was beginning to frighten her. His shoulders were slumped, and when he walked around the room, it was in Chaida's distinctive lope. He always had his dark look now. He examined his face in the glass, pulling actorish expressions, baring his teeth like an animal. She was at her most awake in the height of the night. She could keenly sense the darkness inside him. It was a cold, sharp dark. She wondered if it were the theatre itself that had disconcerted Rosanna, or Detlef. Even though there'd been no chance of identification, Detlef had insisted Kleindienst let him look at the corpse of the Warhawk's latest victim. Genevieve had stood by him while the oilskin sheet was drawn back from the skinless, eyeless face. The repulsive stench of dead blood, spoiled for her, poured off the man in the street. And Detlef had been fascinated, excited, drawn to the horror. Kleindienst's scryer had certainly noticed this unhealthy interest and been sickened by it. Genevieve felt for her.
"Detlef," she asked, "what's wrong?"
He threw up his hands, a typically theatrical gesture. It made people in the back of the stalls feel they knew what he was thinking. But someone close, someone as close as Genevieve, could see the imposture. The mask was loose, and she was glimpsing something behind, something that reminded her horribly of Mr. Chaida.
"Sometimes," he said, struggling with something inside him, "I think of Drachenfels."
She held his hand, slim, strong fingers around his. She too remembered the castle in the grey mountains. She'd been there before Detlef. In truth, she'd suffered more within its walls, had lost more than him.
"It might have been better if we'd been killed," he said. "Then we'd be the ghosts. We wouldn't have to carry on."
She held him in her arms and wondered when she had ceased to understand what went on inside him. Suddenly, he was enthused.
"I think I've found a subject for my next play. It will be something Eva can play the heart out of."
"A comedy," she suggested, hoping. "Something light?"
He ignored her.
"There's never been anything good about the Tsarina Catherine."
The name scraped Genevieve's spine.
"What do you think?" Detlef said, smiling. "Eva as the vampire empress. You could be a technical advisor."
Genevieve nodded, non-committal.
"It would be a fine horror to follow Zykel and Chaida. Catherine was a real fiend, I understand."
"I knew her." Detlef was surprised, then brushed it away.
"Of course, you must have. I never made the connection."
Genevieve remembered the Tsarina. Their association was a part of her life she preferred not to think of too often. There was too much blood in those years, too many hurts, too many betrayals.
"In a sense, we were sisters.
We had the same father in darkness. We were both Chandagnac's get.
Was she...
Genevieve knew what he was thinking. A monster?
Yes, as far as anyone is.
He nodded, satisfied. Genevieve thought of the rivers of blood Catherine had let loose. Her long life had had more than its complement of horrors, and she didn't feel an inclination to conjure them up again, not to supply an audience hungry for sensation and atrocity. There are enough nightmares, Detlef. His head rested on her shoulder, and she could see the scabbed-over marks she'd left on his neck. She wanted to taste him, and yet she was afraid of what might be in his blood, what she might catch from him. How much of his darkness had he caught from her? In his Catherine play, did he intend to take the role of Vladislav Voryetsky, the Empress's poet lover? Eva would be perfect casting for the monster queen. Perhaps she was condemning Detlef too easily. It could be that she was as dark in her soul as he was in his obsessions. His work had only teemed with the macabre and monstrous since he had been with her. Bleeding a man sometimes meant taking things from him other than blood. Maybe Genevieve was a truer sister in darkness to Catherine the Great than she liked to think.
Never enough nightmares, Genet, he murmured.
She kissed Detlef's neck, but did not break the skin. He was exhausted, but not asleep. They stayed locked together for a long time, not moving, not talking. Another day crept up on them. Chapter 14. Last night, the trapdoor demon had heard Detlef and Genevieve talking about him. Papa Fritz had reminisced about the days before he began to alter, the days when he'd been Bruno Malvoisin. The playwright he had been seemed now like another person, a role he had cast off with his human flesh. In the passage behind the rehearsal rooms, where he was able to look in on the company at work, he stretched his major tentacles to their utmost length. Usually, he wrapped himself in a cloak and held the centre of his body high, imagining a belly and two human legs below his chest. Today, he let himself flop naturally, six tentacles spreading like the pad of a water lily, the clump of his other external organs and the hard blades of his beak protected by the leathery tent of his body. There was very little of Malvoisin left. In the rehearsal room, Detlef was reading notes to the company. This morning he had few comments, distracted by the swirl of events around the play rather than fully involved in the drama itself. The trapdoor demon was puzzled by Eva. His protégé sat aside as usual, Reinhardt hovering guiltily while paying overdone attentions to Ilona. Eva was calm and in control again, different from last night. It was as if she'd never seen his true form. Or maybe she'd found the strength in herself to accept what she had seen. Whatever the case, she wasn't concerned this morning with the monster she had met last night. A few of the chorus girls had been prattling about a murder outside the theatre. The trapdoor demon knew nothing of that, except that he'd eventually be blamed. As Malvoisin, he had written about evil, about how attractive it could be, how seductive a path. When he began to change, he had thought that he had himself succumbed to Sally's temptations, as Diogo Breizac in Seduced by Slaneshi had to his own private demons. Then, as he became less bound by human thinking, he came to recognise there was no more evil in him when his shape changed than there had been before. In a sense, he'd been freed by his mutation. Perhaps that was the laugh line of Zinche's jest at his expense, that he could only be aware of his humanity once his human form was buried in a morass of squiddy, altered flesh. Still, he realised that for others, Warpstone was a polluter of the soul as well as the body. Watching Genevieve, who was herself watching Detlev with a new attentiveness. The trapdoor demon wondered whether a warpstone shard had shot into his protege. Eva Savinian had changed, and she was changing still. He had allowed the company to break up for lunch and told them they did not have to come back until the evening's performance. The strange history of Dr. Zykiel and Mr. Chaida was rolling of its own accord now, and Detlef was almost at the point when, even if everything else were not falling apart, he would have been prepared to let it alone. Long-run shows developed by themselves, finding ways to stay alive. He was even grateful to Eva Savinian, whose unpredictable luminescence was prodding everyone in the company in unexpected directions. Ilona, for instance, was suggesting that she might have the makings of a tragic heroine as she slipped into the age range for roles like the Empress Margrethe or Ottokar's wife. In Papa Fritz's rooms he found Genevieve, surrounded by unscrolled maps, weighted down at the corners with books and small objects. She was with the stage doorkeeper and Guglielmo, trying to make sense of the diagrams of the tunnels under the theatre. "So," she said, "we're agreed? This one is a deliberate fraud, to be found by the enemies of someone taking refuge." The older-looking men nodded. "It's too clearly marked," Guglielmo said. "Obviously, it's designed to get anyone who relies on it hopelessly lost, possibly even to lead them into traps."
"What are you three conspirators up to?" Detlef asked. "Plotting to join Prince Klojowski's revolutionist movement?"
"I'm going to try to find him," Genevieve said. She was dressed in clothes Detlef had not seen her wear in years. In Altdorf, she was usually found in subdued but elegant finery, white silks and embroidered Cathayan robes. Now she wore a leather hunting jacket and boots, with sturdy cloth trews and a man's shirt. She looked like Violetta, disguised as her twin brother, in Taradash's Hex Nachtabend.
"Im?"
"Malvoisin."
"The trapdoor demon,"
Papa Fritz explained. In the gloom, the old man looked like a crumpled parchment himself.
"Genet. Why?"
"I think he's suffering."
"The whole world is suffering."
"I can't do anything about the whole world."
"What can you do for this creature, even if he is Bruno Malvoisin?"
"Talk to him. Find out if he needs anything." I think he was as frightened as Eva by what happened. Papa Fritz rolled up the fake map and slipped it into its tube, coughing in the dust that belched from it.
"He's some kind of altered Genet. His mind must be gone. He could be dangerous."
"Like Varga was dangerous, Detlef?" Varga Bruegel had been Detlef's stage manager and assistant. A dwarf born of normal parents, he'd been with the actor-playwright-director since the beginning of his career. In the end, he'd turned out to be an altered thing of chaos and had killed himself rather than be tortured by a stupid man.
"Like you were dangerous?"
Detlef had been born with 6 toes on 1 foot. His merchant father had remedied the defect in early childhood with a meat cleaver.
"Like I am dangerous?"
She opened her sharp-toothed mouth wide and made play claws of her hands. Then she dropped her monster face. "You know as well as I do that warpstone sometimes just makes a monster of you on the outside."
"Very well. But take some of your bruises with you."
Genevieve laughed and crushed a prop candlestick into a squeezed ball of metal. "I'd only have to look after them, Detlef."
"It's your life, Genet," he said, wearied. "You do what you want with it."
"I certainly intend to.
Papa Fritz, I'll go in here," tapping a chart. "From the stalls, we'll have to break open this old trapdoor."
"Genet,"
he said, laying a hand on her shoulder. A child sometimes, she was also ancient. She kissed him, quickly. I'll be careful, she said. Reinhard Jessner knew he was being a fool, but couldn't help himself. He knew he was hurting Ilona and would be hurting their twins, Erzbet and Rudy. In the end, he was hurting himself most of all. But there was something about Eva. She was in his blood like snake poison, and it couldn't be sucked out with a simple bite. Since the first night of Dr. Zykil and Mr. Chaida, the bane was creeping through him. He had known it at the party afterwards. One or other of them was always going to make a move. It had been her, but it could as easily have been him. He felt physically sick when he was away from her, unable to think of anything, of anyone else. And when he was with her, there was a different kind of pain, a gnawing guilt, a self-disgust, an awareness of his own foolishness. The more he loved Eva, the more certain he was the girl would leave him. He could do nothing more for her. He was a stepping stone, half sunk in the stream. There were larger, sturdier stones ahead. Eva would go on to them. They had snatched a few hours together away from the theatre in the afternoon, rutting in the hot dark behind the drawn curtains of her upstairs room. She had already outpaced and outworn him, slipping into an easeful sleep, while he, exhausted, lay next to her in her narrow bed, mind crowded and uncomfortable. This was not the first time, but it was the worst. Before, Ilona had known, but been able to bear it. The other girls had not lasted, could not last. He had half thought Ilona had encouraged him to be unfaithful, and they had been better together afterwards than before. Theatrical marriages were difficult and usually foundered. Little diversions gave them strength to carry on. Now, Ilona was in tears all the time. At home, the twins were forever fighting and demanding. He spent as little time there as possible, preferring either to be with Eva or at the Temple Street Gymnasium, fencing and lifting weights. Eva shifted beside him, and the covers fell away from her sleeping face. Daylight dotted in through the rough weave of the curtains, and Reinhard looked down at the girl. An ice kiss touched him. As she slept, Eva looked strange, as if there was a layer of thin glass stretched over her face. Reinhard caught strange, almost reflections in the surface. He touched her cheek and found it hard, like a statue. As his fingertips pressed, the quality of her skin changed, becoming yielding, warm. Her eyes opened, and she took his wrist in a surprisingly strong grip. He was truly afraid of her now. Eva sat up, pushing him back against the plastered wall, her warm body against his, her face empty of expression. Reinhard, she said, there are things you must do for me. Chapter 15. The labyrinth was different here. While the passages behind the dressing rooms were cramped, these were almost spacious, the underground equivalents of thoroughfares. Odd items had drifted down from the world above. One corridor was lined with flats from various productions, laid end to end, so mountain scenery gave way to Darkland's jungle, then to the plasterboard flagstones and painted bloodstains of a dungeon, then to a storm-whipped seascape on springs, so it would roll behind a stage ship, then to the corpse-littered chaos wastes. Genevieve tried to remember which plays went with each canvas. She sensed her quarry was close. The box 7 smell lingered faintly, and she had better nostrils than true humans. Some of the painted scenes had dried slime smudges on them, indicating that the trapdoor demon used this path. She wondered if she should call out, or if that would drive Malvoisin further into hiding. Having spent so many of her years penned up in one way or another, she could imagine what kind of life the trapdoor demon had down here. What she couldn't imagine was him finding any other kind of life. Humans barely tolerated her, and were invariably hostile to any of her kind who shape-changed. It wasn't an unfounded prejudice, but it was also not entirely just. The passageway angled down and ended in a curtained chamber. She looked around for the trapdoor and found it, disguised as the top of a large barrel. Originally, the tunnel had had a ladder for human use, but that had mainly been scraped away, replaced by a set of protuberances that gave Genevieve an idea of what Malvoisin must look like. The smell was very strong, a whiff of dead fish and salt water rising from the depths. For now, she left the tunnel alone, replacing the barrel top. Today, she was going to search only the uppermost levels. She suspected Malvoisin might choose to loiter near the surface. She'd found many of his peepholes and been amused by the private rooms into which they afforded a view. Obviously, the trapdoor demon alleviated his solitude by taking an interest in the company of the Varga Bruegel Memorial Playhouse. She wondered how many of her own private moments had been overseen. From a peephole accessible if she stood on the barrel, she could see into a stockroom where, among the dusty wig stands and tins of face powder, she had once bled Detlef intimately. The red thirst had come upon her during a reception, and she had dragged her lover to this forgotten corner of the theatre, taking mouthfuls of his flesh and gently puncturing his excited skin, gorging herself until he was dangerously weak. A half dozen new wounds opened on his body. Had once human eyes witnessed her lustful gluttony? Retracing her footsteps to the last horizontal junction, she explored a new fork. Nearby, there was a rapid slithering, and she darted in its direction, her night sight enabling her not to slam into a wall. She didn't call out. Something large was moving fast. The slithering turned a corner, and she followed it. There was no movement of air, so she guessed this was a closed space. She came to a wall and stopped. She couldn't hear anything now. Looking back, she realized she'd been fooled. They didn't call Malvoisin the trapdoor demon lightly. Somehow, he'd slipped into the walls, ceiling or floor, and escaped her. However, she was canny, and she had time. The Animus let Eva guide it to the theatre, with Reinhardt as thoroughly in tow as if he were a pig led by a brass ring through his nose. From Eva, it had learned that destroying Detlef and Genevieve wasn't enough for its purpose. Before they died, they must be broken apart. The bond forged at the Fortress of Drachenfels sundered completely. That way, they'd die knowing nothing lasting had come of their triumph. The Animus was grateful for the new insight, realizing at last that it hadn't been prepared to do its master's bidding until it joined with its current host. The great enchanter must have foreseen this when he forged the Animus, realizing his creature wouldn't be whole until it was partially human. It was gathering about itself the tools it needed. Eva, of course, was the key. But others, Reinhardt, Ilona, the trapdoor demon, even Detlef and Genevieve themselves, must play their parts. For Eva, the Animus was very like Detlef, conceiving a drama and then guiding his company through their parts. The Animus was not above being flattered by the comparison. Created as a cold intellect, it bore the vampire and the play actor no malice. It just knew that their destruction was its purpose. From Eva, it had learned a considerable respect for Detlef Sieck's prowess as a man of the theatre. Eva left Reinhardt at the Temple Street Gymnasium for his afternoon exercises, knowing he would come when needed. The host had her own purpose, distinct from that of the Animus. For the moment, their ambitions meshed neatly. If a conflict ever arose, each was confident of victory over the other. The Animus let Eva go on, thinking she was in control. Outside the theatre, there were three distinct crowds. The largest was an unruly queue at the box office, demanding seats for The Strange History of Dr. Zykel and Mr. Chaida. A few well-known touts were preying on these, charging unbelievable prices for genuine tickets and slightly more credible coin for badly forged imitations, which would never pass Guglielmo Pentangeli's ushers. Competing with the eager would-be patrons was a line of placard-waving petitioners, mostly well-dressed matrons and thin young men in shabby clothes, protesting against the play. One placard was a vivid poster of Detlef as Mr. Chaida, showing him as a giant trampling over the murdered citizens of Altdorf. Since the last host's death, the protests had increased fourfold. As Eva neared, the third crowd were aroused to activity. These she was gradually becoming used to. There were liveried footmen with floral offerings and billets doux and formal invitations, and well-dressed young men keen to pursue their suits in person. Besides romantic overtures, Eva Savinian was daily pestered by professional offers from all over the empire and as far off as Britannia and Kislev. There could be no doubt that the young actress was the toast of Altdorf. Graciously accepting flowers, invitations and letters, Eva passed through the crowd, politely fending off the more persistent suitors. Slipping through the front door, she immediately dumped her crop of tributes into the arms of Papa Fritz, who staggered under the burden. She would go through the letters later. "You should start sending your flowers to the retreat of Shalya," a voice said. It was Ilona. Eva turned, squashing a mouse of irritation in her mind. She didn't want this distraction now. "That's what I did in the last century, when I was in your position. Flowers move you out of your dressing room and are no real use. The patients at the hospital will at least get something out of them." "A good idea," Eva agreed. "Thank you, Ilona." "We should talk, Eva," the older woman said. "Not now." Ilona looked sharply at Eva, eyes penetrating. It was as if she knew something, saw something. The Animus knew this was not possible. Not now. "Take care, Eva. You've charted a dangerous